Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by my co-host Frank Cagliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
I'm doing great. We finished exam boards yesterday, so all things are well here in Edinburgh.
Yeah, let's have our first. Let's have our toast now.
Exactly. Cheers.
Cheers.
And for our American listeners, especially American academics, we have this whole post-exam, before the summer really starts, series of meetings called exam boards, which are a kind of special torture that we suffer through. All right, so one of the stories that's been, I guess, in the news for the past several weeks has been really horrifying stories of immigrant families being split up at the border, both people who are immigrating illegally and people who are seeking asylum. And we're getting these really sort of horrific stories and images in the news of families being split up, children being taken from their parents. And lots of the outrage, been a huge amount of outrage at these stories, often people claiming this is, you know, deeply un-American to break up families. But one of the things that struck me, and I think it's probably struck you too, Frank, is that there's a very long history, in fact, in the United States of splitting up families. This actually has very deep roots in American history, this idea that the state can intervene between parents and children.
It does indeed, David. And I mean, before we get into the details of this week's topic, it is worth observing that when we were having our discussion about what to talk about this week, to some extent we were spoiled for choice.
Yes.
Because the news is coming thick and fast at the moment. In fact, today President Trump is at the G7 summit in Quebec, and he's on his way to Singapore.
G6 plus one.
Yeah, the G6 plus one, or the G6 plus one person sulking in the corner. I felt a little bit vindicated in the choices we made over the past few months. So we did an episode on trade and tariffs and trade wars, and it looks like we're having that. We talked about pardons months ago.
Yeah,
we've had
exactly.
A lot of pardons. And so they've been... One of the things we considered doing was trying to tie up all these loose ends, but I think it's really, really important to talk about this issue, and I know you agree, because, first of all, it's an ongoing problem or issue in the United States, and as you said in your intro, it actually has deep roots. I mean, when Americans, particularly progressive Americans, or people trying to protest against injustice, say, this isn't the American way, that's a kind of verbal trope that serves a useful purpose, but often we find that the activity being protested actually does have deep roots in the United States, and splitting up or taking children from their parents is one of those things.
Yeah.
Most notably, of course, David, under slavery, and you've got far more expertise in the history of slavery than I do. I mean, can you comment
on
that?
Sure. So, I mean, one of the things that's one of the many horrors of slavery is that slave families have no legal status, right? Slave marriages aren't legal. Slave parents don't have any claim to their children. And, you know, that slave families can be split up by sale, you know, at any time. And this seems to have happened really from the very beginning of American slavery. If you look in Virginia, the rights that the slave owner had to the slave children seems to have started very early. But it seems to, the rate of family breakup seems to accelerate, in fact, after the American Revolution, when they closed the transatlantic slave trade. And as the slave frontier, as the cotton frontier opens up, you know, in the first half of the 19th century, because you have... I think most of our listeners know a great deal about the Middle Passage. You have what is often called a second Middle Passage between 1808 and 1860, in which a million African Americans are moved from the Upper South to the Lower South into places like Alabama and Mississippi, Louisiana and Texas. You know, one way...
From places like Virginia and Maryland,
which often had a, you know, in the nomenclature of time, the kind of a slave surplus. And, you know, when I teach about this to undergraduates, one way I sort of try to contextualize this for them is, this is one way to think about these million people, is these are a million families broken up, because the internal slave trade, you know, one of the horrors of it was the ways in which it broke up families, in which the auction block served as a place in which families would be split up. You know, there historians have tried to estimate, you know, to what extent did slave families break up, and Michael Tadman at one point did some calculations and estimated that one out of three black children lost a parent because of the slave trade. So it's a very, you know, the integrity of black families in slavery was challenged on a daily basis.
And we have lots and lots of harrowing accounts of children being ripped from their parents,
to be sure,
and sold, or their parents being sold.
Well, one of the tropes that the abolitionist movement used, one of the sort of main arguments that they said to describe the evils of slavery, is they look, this tears apart the most fundamental human connections we have, that between parents and children. You know, and so the image of a mother having her child ripped away from her at the auction block, you know, is a story that is repeated over and over again, not only in real life, but, you know, becomes one of the ways in which they're able to explain why slavery is so evil to the northern public. People are reading abolitionist newspapers and magazines and reading fugitive slave narratives. You know, and I think if you read, you know, Frederick Douglass, for instance, begins his narrative by talking about the fact that he grew up on a separate plantation from his mother, and that, you know, he only got to see her a handful of times, and she had to sneak out in the middle of the night from her own plantation after having worked all day to come see him, and describes his mother holding him as a very small child, and then her having to leave before sunrise to get back to her own plantations. And so, you know, and that's a case in which, you know, they're actually not that radically far apart, but many more slave narratives describe parents being sold away, or parents describing children being sold away and never seeing them again, them being sold, you know, literally down the river to this cotton frontier, and having huge numbers of families being broken up. And slave owners justified this in a couple of ways. I mean, one, slave owners claimed this didn't happen very much, or that only bad slave owners did this. And if you look at the records, almost all slave owners did this.
Only bad slaves were sold.
Well, yeah, so they claimed this would only happen as punishment. We know, though, if you look at any plantation records, any time a slave... This was the most liquid form of capital that most slave owners had. So if they got into debt, selling slaves is the way they did it. If they, anytime a slave owner died, this is the way you settled their accounts in probate, as you sold off some of their slaves to pay off their debts and to split up the slaves among their heirs. So slave owners justified it, saying, look, we don't sell bad slaves, we don't sell them very often. And this is actually an argument Thomas Jefferson made, and you find it repeated in the generations to follow. He says, look, slaves don't really feel the kinds of family connections that white people do. You know, that you know, we can sell their children away, but they get over it quickly. You know, and so they sort of dehumanize the slaves even further by saying, look, we can sell their children from them. They can have more children. It's not a pressing concern that we should concern, you know, matter.
One of the points you made in your introduction, David, was about the role of the state. And
sure.
I think that's one of the things we want to focus on here.
Mm.
In terms of the internal slave trade and the breaking up of families, and I'm in no way trying to diminish the significance of that, but with this particular aspect, from this particular perspective, what role does the state play in that?
Well, so
because one could argue these are private transactions, you know, within capitalism, right?
Yes, okay. So there's a couple ways in which the state's deeply involved in this. One, of course, is that the state is involved by creating the whole sort of legislative framework that enables slavery to happen, that says that slave children belong to their owners, that the condition of slavery passes through the condition of the mother, all these things that you can be traced back to, you know, 17th century Virginia. You know, in some states, in part because of the abolitionist critique, actually passed laws saying you can't break up slave families. You can't sell children below a certain age. I think Louisiana does this, maybe Alabama and one or two other states try to do this. In practice, though, those laws were never, ever enforced. And I think so, simply by their non-enforcement of their own laws, I think the state is complicit, really, you know, in breaking up of slave families. If you look at, you know, the great epicenters of the slave trade, Richmond, New Orleans, you know, these are slave families that are being broken up in public view, you know, on the auction block. And so it was not something that's happening. These are not private transactions that are happening necessarily, you know, behind closed doors, although that happened, you know, millions of times as well. These are public transactions where everyone is deeply aware of what's happening, the ways in which the slave trade is embedded with the state. You know, in many southern communities, slave auctions are held on the county courthouses. You know, so there's a you know, deep involvement in the state in that way.
And I suppose the existence of the slave patrol, which is intended to keep the whole system
working, yeah,
is the use of state violence.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you know, slavery undergirds everything in the antebellum South. You know, from you know, the political structure, the economic system, you know. So the state's very deeply involved in, you know.
But could one draw a distinction, to use the terrible situation we used as our jumping off point, the forcible separation of children from their parents by the United States government in the form of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. That's the direct active engagement of the state to separate families. Whereas under what you're describing in terms of the internal slave trade is more complicity by the state.
Well, but there are times. There's one great example. There's a wonderful book by Adam Rothman came out just a few years ago called Beyond Freedom's Reach, which looks at a situation of one slave family in New Orleans during the Civil War. The sort of brief version of it is New Orleans is part of the Confederacy for a very brief period, but then is occupied by the Union Army. A slave-owning family decides to go to Cuba and decides to take some enslaved children with them. And this is before the Emancipation Proclamation. And the slave mother goes and says, look, you know, those are Confederate sympathizers. They're taking my children away to a different country. Please, I want my family back. And the U.S. government throws up their hands and says, sorry, slavery is legal. The slave owner has the right to take their property wherever they want. And the story ends eventually with the family able to be reconciled. But it's it's a very lengthy fight to make that happen. But the state, you know, repeatedly intervenes, siding with the rights of slave owners to slave children over their parents. You're thinking about how this sort of story plays out, sort of the long run of this story. There's been a lot of really remarkable work done, especially over the past decade, looking at efforts by African Americans in the decades after the Civil War to reconstruct families, to find lost parents and children and siblings and spouses that have been broken up by the slave trade. There's a wonderful book by Heather Williams, that must be 10 years old now, that starts to look at this process. You know, and sometimes families are looking not only in 1865, but you know, in 1885, they're still trying to find, you know, the child that was sold away from them. You know, in 1850, and trying to say that, you know, I think he went to Mississippi. I heard he went to Texas. I think this is the name of the person who bought him. Please, if anybody knows anything. And there's a wonderful digital project being done right now at Villanova University, run by Judy Giesberg, called the Last Seen Project, where they are taking a lot of the advertisements. One of the things that newly freed African Americans do, they place ads in newspapers trying to find their lost family members, and they're in the process of trying to digitize, you know, literally the thousands of ads that were placed, you know, by family members trying to find lost loved ones.
Kind of an interesting counterpoint to all those antebellum advertisements for runaway slaves.
It's exactly the same, right? It's sort of the same it's playing on similar kinds of networks of information. It also should be worth pointing out, thinking about sort of the aftermath of all this, that when slavery is abolished in the South, that doesn't mean that black parents necessarily had rights to their children, or at least had the same rights to their children that free people did, or that free white people did. One of the hallmarks of the black codes that Southern states passed in 1865 and 1866 are apprenticeship laws that basically give the state the power to remove children from parents they see as being unfit parents, and then apprentice them to people as laborers. What this means in practice is the state was taking away black children from black parents and giving them often to former slave owners, often to their former slave owners, and saying, here, this child is now apprenticed to this landowner as a, you know, to work until they are 18. So it's kind of a slavery light, if you will, or kind of way of creating a bonded labor class. And then parents, once their children are bound out like this, basically have the choice of how they want to be with their children. They're compelled really to contract with those same landowners so they can live and work near their children. But sort of creates a vehicle, you know, for taking away poor people's children from them.
Well, not just poor people's children, though, but
poor black people's children. Yeah. So the ways in which I think, you know, one of the things I think we're going to see throughout this episode is the ways in which race and to a lesser extent class, but also class really functions, you know, the rights that parents have to children, you know, throughout American history. Poor people and minorities often have, you know, their children taken away from them against their will, and their parenting ideas challenged, and their rights to their children very much, you know, contested.
I mean, thanks for that, David. I mean, this begs the question, and maybe we should have begun with this, but your comments, you're very informed and enlightening comments in the past few minutes have struck a chord with me. One thing we perhaps need to consider is just what it means to be a child and what the history of childhood is in the United States. Because on one hand, we think we know when you say a child, what a child is historically, but of course these categories have changed over time. You know, the Puritans, for example, saw children as just miniature people, miniature adults.
And you see this, in fact, in like Puritan art. If you look at the ways in which they draw children, they look like just adults, but mini-sized.
That's right. Yeah. They look like tiny, tiny adults, including the babies.
Yeah, exactly.
And in part, that's because life was cheap in the 17th century. People died, and children frequently died. Child mortality, I think, factors into this.
And weird Puritan theology about predestination, other kinds of things.
Sure. I mean, so they often don't name their children right away.
Sure. Don't want to waste a good name.
Or they give children the same name over and over when they die. And anyway, in terms of the history of childhood, so I'm thinking about the example you gave of bonded labor, African American children being used as bonded labor during Reconstruction. I would imagine that some of the folks who were using that labor, a former slaveholder in Alabama, for example, who feels that he needs labor, he needs a labor force to replace the one he's lost as a result of emancipation, wouldn't necessarily think of childhood and the people who are working for him as children in the way that we might. Is that a fair statement?
Well, so, I mean, I think there's a sort of a double-edged part to this, because, you know, on one hand, these apprenticeship laws did recognize there was a distinction between adults and children, right? So you can't apprentice, and although they did have vagrancy laws that worked much the same way, they weren't taking, you know, these apprenticeships often lasted until the person reached adulthood, so there was still recognition that adulthood existed.
And that there is a status of adulthood.
Yes.
That's different from what came before.
Children. And also, clearly, they're not, you know, but they're also the the children that are being taken, in this case, though, through the apprenticeship laws, tend to be the children who are able to work, right? So they're not taking infants. They're taking people who are able to engage in the kind of physical labor that landowners, former slave owners, would want, picking cotton or whatever it is, right? So there is sort of a simultaneous recognition that these are, you know, they're laborers, and able to engage in adult labor, even if they're not, you know, legally of an adult age. You know, and I guess it is worth pointing out that in the 19th century, of course, many children are working. That working class
of all races. Is,
yes, yes. So it, you know, there was, you know, widespread child labor. So if you were poor, regardless of your, you know, skin color or previous condition of servitude, the odds are your children are going to be working in some capacity, either on a farm or, you know, thinking later in the century, in a sort of an industrial capacity. So this is an era in which, you know, we often divide now in the 21st century. We think of childhood is for play and for education, and adulthood is when you work. Those distinctions, I think, are very modern distinctions that really evolved in the 20th century. But, you know, when you think about the 19th century, those weren't distinctions that I think were as clear.
Yeah, I mean, one of the achievements of the progressive era is protecting children, isn't it, and child laborers, and recognizing children as a kind of distinct category.
Yeah, so, I mean, you think about, you know, when some of these distinctions, when we think about just especially sort of, you know, court, special courts for children, separate kinds of ways of having legal procedures for children, as being distinct from those from adults, all that can be attributed, for better or for ill, to the progressives, who really see childhood as something worth protecting, and as a sort of sacred time.
And then slightly later, I guess, although it's not quite an outgrowth of it, is we see the emergence of the concept of adolescence, which is distinct, is this phase between childhood and adulthood.
Right. And you start to see that in the 20s, but I think it, you know, really emerges, especially in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, adolescence is the product of a wealthy society.
Yeah.
And both having the time and wealth to allow individuals in that stage of life to recognize that. And one of the things we're seeing is adolescence is being extended. I mean, one sees on social media that now adolescence extends to the age of 30. Now, I don't think people are taking that seriously, but you do see it.
Well, there was that court case a couple of weeks ago about the 30-something-year-old who was living with their parents and living with his parents and had to get evicted from his parents' house by the courts because.
Yes, I pointed that out to my son. And we see this with, and we need to get back to the matter in hand, but we see this with the way that some of President Trump's defenders refer to the actions of his children, not Ivanka to the same extent as Eric and Don Jr., where they say, well, they're just kids, or they made mistakes, but they're kids. Well, no.
Eric's 40.
Yeah, the boys.
No, Donald Jr.
They're in their 30s or 40s. You know, they are not kids by any stretch of the imagination, but and we don't need to belabor that. But my point being, I guess, we see
childhood is a historically constructed category.
Yes, and the notion of what childhood means has changed over time. Adolescence is a relatively late category that's emerged in the last century, really. And so we just need to bear that in mind, I suppose, as context to understand what we're talking about in terms of what happened to African-Americans, but also some of the other people we should speak about. Do you have more to add about the African-American experience?
I think if you look at sort of the long history, you know, after emancipation, you know, black children are often very much at the sort of center of the, you know, not so much necessarily in taking them from their parents, all that happens as well. You know, they are often at the sort of center of political fights, whether that comes to schools, whether that comes to policing. You know, that the black experience in childhood is a radically different one than the white experience in childhood. And I think the roots of that difference about what childhood means and the way childhood and family are constructed, you know, starts in some ways in slavery. It's evolves in all kinds of really important ways afterwards, but the, you know, the black family experience, and the dynamics with the state in particular are have been troubling really ever since then.
Well, one only needs to consider, and these are just the recent examples, but the number of young African Americans killed by the police in recent years, which has given rise to the Black Lives Matter movement, the absurd dispute over the national anthem at football games. We don't have to talk about that again necessarily, but the underlying cause of that, quite clearly the state is willing to deploy much greater force against African American children to this day than children than white children.
Yes.
I think that's
there's a childhood privilege that is extended to white children that is not extended necessarily to people of color.
Right. Yeah. It's not just black children, of course, as we're seeing with the incidents on the border right now. And I suppose trying to broaden the categories that takes us to Native Americans.
Sure.
And another really prominent example of the state separating parents and children is the Native American boarding school movement, or the Native American school movement, which has very, very deep roots. It goes back to the 17th century, actually, if one thinks about the praying towns in Massachusetts. Harvard and Dartmouth, for example, had their origins in part as institutions which were meant to educate Native American people, and by educate, it's to convert them to Christianity and European methods of agriculture, and basically teaching Native Americans to become like European Americans. And there's a strong assimilationist tradition in government policy going back, well, as I said, to the colonial period, but certainly in the early Republic and beyond. I mean, it was a kind of article of faith among white Native American advocates that assimilation was the only way to save Indians.
Yeah.
And this was very, very prominent during the early 19th century, but really gained steam.
Yeah, it really takes off after the Civil War.
After the Civil War.
And the most famous of the sort of wave of schools that are created after the Civil War is the Carlisle Industrial School.
Right.
Which is really run in some ways as a military school intending to transform Native children into American quote unquote children. The head of the school, a guy by the name of Richard Henry Pratt, famously said that part of the objective of the school was to kill the Indian and save the man.
Right.
And so children who were sent to Carlisle, they would be forced to get their hair cut, which has all kinds of symbolic attachments for certain Native peoples. They're given new names. They're forced to speak
Christian names,
right? So they're really sort of reborn in some ways when they are, or stripped of all their cultural identity when they're sent to school. So they're given a new name. They're given a new haircut. They're given new clothes. They are given a new language. They're prohibited from speaking, and often punished, quite violently for speaking Native languages. They are given a new religious practice. They're sort of forced Christianity upon them. And the accounts that we have of these schools, especially the first generation of them, is in some ways, you get two contradictory messages. One is that the people who are running the schools think that what they're doing is beneficial to these children. They say, look, Native Americans are dying out. Thinking about sort of the long narrative of Native Americans on the frontier, these schools are opening, at the same time that we're having, the Great Indian Wars on the Plains, but in which it looks like Native American extinction is actually in the, potential offing. And, the people running the schools describe what they're doing as a humanitarian effort to save these children from a doomed existence on reservations. The descriptions we have of these schools from the Native American, from the children who went to these schools, is that it really is places of immense violence, The death rate at the schools was very, very high. Lots of the children emerge malnourished. They seem to be overcrowded. And a kind of cultural genocide is taking place in these schools. Because when the children grow up and they go back home, they can't speak the same language that their parents do. They don't have the same religious identity, and so they don't really fit in anywhere after emerging from these schools, because they're still seen as Indian by mainstream white society, but they're not seen as Indian by the communities they're coming from, and so it's really creating a cultural void.
One of the consequences of the assimilation movement, or one of the features of it, I should say, rather than consequences, is that Native peoples who embrace assimilation or are compelled to assimilate can never quite assimilate enough.
No,
it's
yes,
never
exactly.
quite enough.
Yes.
So even those who attempt to assimilate fail, or those who are coerced into assimilating are seen as limited in some way. What's amazing about these schools, and we had a student, a recent master's student,
sure.
who wrote a dissertation about this for us, is these Native American boarding schools existed to the 1970s.
Yeah. When I lived in North Dakota, I actually taught alongside several people who had attended these schools as children, had family members attended these schools as children. And the schools in this 20th century weren't necessarily as violent and as brutal experience as some of the ones in the end of the 19th century, although they are described fairly horrifically by many of the survivors of these schools. There's something on the order of sort of 60,000 Native Americans were in these schools in 1970, so these are fairly recent, experience for many Native peoples, and it's really only been since then that the schools have mostly been shut down. I think there are still one or two of them that are still open, but one of the sort of great tasks of the Native American rights movement that starts in the 60s and 70s is try to sort of undo the work that these boarding schools did in terms of trying to reclaim Native languages and cultures, trying to reclaim religious practices and identity that the schools were systematically trying to strip away.
It's worth observing that there were very similar institutions in other Anglophone countries. Mm. So in Canada, there was a very similar school movement, which was closely parallel to what happened in the United States, where the schools were run on behalf of the government, often by Christian missionaries, and the similar practices prevailed. We also see indigenous people treated in a similar way and taken from their parents and put into schools in Australia and New Zealand as
sure.
well. So it's this is a more widespread practice. It's an aspect of colonialism,
to be sure.
And
right.
you see it in other settler societies.
Yeah. I mean, the schools emerge at the same point that you have things like the Dawes Act, which tried to sort of break apart reservations and transform indigenous landowning practices into, the kinds of private ownership of land and agriculture that whites on the frontier.
Yes, if you all just become
like
independent
us,
family farmers,
everything
like
will
us,
be fine. Right.
Everything will be all right. That's the premise
of it.
As I said, though, for assimilationists, or certainly for the opponents of assimilation, who covet native lands, among other things, they can never do enough.
To be sure, right? No.
So, to some extent, it's a false goal, or it's a goal that can never be achieved.
Mm.
And these schools were certainly state action. So in that sense, I mean,
well, they were state action, but they're often privately run by religious organizations.
Right. Well,
and so there's
but state sanctioned.
To be sure, yeah,
and Native peoples much more clearly fall under the kind of purview of the state than even African Americans did to some extent. The exploitation of African Americans was to some extent a byproduct of capitalism and private property.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs is very much strong. They're theoretically Native parents could refuse to send their children to these schools, but the Bureau of Indian Affairs put a pretty heavy thumb on Native communities to push them to send their children to these schools.
Well, and let's not forget, Reconstruction extends citizenship to African Americans. Native Americans don't become citizens of the United States until 1924.
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah. So
their legal rights and recourses are pretty limited.
That's right. That's right.
So we've been talking most, you know, almost actually exclusively here about minority children being taken from their parents. But there are some examples in American history of white children being taken from their parents. And probably the biggest example that I'm familiar with, at least, are the orphan trains, which are kind of misnomer because they're often not actually orphans.
Yes, I was about to say, if they're orphans, have they been taken from their parents? So can you explain?
So the orphan train system, if we can call it that, starts in the 1850s and really lasts until the 1920s. Yeah, it really lasts until 29, maybe into the whole Great Depression era. And the sort of the epicenter of it was New York City, where groups like the Children's Aid Society take children, some of whom are orphans, but some of whom are runaway children who have living parents but have run away, some of whom are simply the children of people who are poor, children of single mothers, and remove them from their homes or from the street and ship them, sometimes by train, hence orphan train, but oftentimes using other modes of transportation, to families often in the Midwest, but also in Connecticut and New Jersey and upstate New York and what have you. And the basic system was they would take the children from New York and export them. We have something in the order of 200,000 children. It's a lot of children. And if you were a farmer in the Midwest and you wanted to acquire one of these children, all you had to basically do was go to the train station when the train showed up and said, yes, I'll take this one and that one. And you would be, there was very little by way of either sort of background checks for these potential, adoptees is actually the wrong word because they're often not legally adopted, but for these adults to take custody of these children or follow-up checks afterwards. And what we know from the records of children who were engaged in, who were trafficked, if you will, if one way to think about this is this child trafficking, is that sometimes they were taken in by families who were childless, who wanted a child and raised them as their own children. But often, very often, these children were basically used as more or less indentured servants, as agricultural laborers, where families would go and say, we need more manpower on our farm. They went to the orphan train, they got themselves a couple of teenage boys, and then they coerced them into labor. So it's the story of the orphan train, you can tell a number of different stories depending on how you want, which individual child's experience you're following. Some of them had very unhappy childhoods in New York and end up getting adopted by a loving family in Iowa. And some of them had, were taken from their parents against their will and against the parents' will, and then basically sold into a kind of quasi-slavery. And I think what this has in common with some of these other experiences we're talking about is, these are parents who have, very little power or authority in society. They're poor parents. They're often immigrant parents. They may not have a great command of thinking about what New York looks like at the middle part of the 19th century into the 20th century. They may not have a great command of English. And, the state, working in conjunction with these charitable organizations, is taking children away, on this assumption, and in some ways this sort of ties in with the boarding school, we know better what's good for your children more than you do.
Thanks for that. I mean, I think there's a couple of interesting dimensions to this, which is it's premised, the orphan train seemed to me to be premised on a couple of assumptions about kind of the ideal way society should be organized. Sure. So one is cities are bad. Mm. And there's a long tradition in America of kind of anxiety and concern about cities. So taking poor or orphan children away from a bad urban environment and putting them in the country must by definition be good. The other is taking them away from institutions like orphanages and placing them in families. So you're better off with a family in Iowa than you would be living on the streets of New York.
Yes.
And those twin impulses are quite profound and strong, and yeah. I would argue even to this day.
Oh, to be sure. I think one of the things you see, you know, the legacies of these kinds of things you see today, you know, is organizations, you know, state organizations like child welfare services, where, you know, they are state agencies empowered to take children away from what, you know, they perceive as unhealthy home conditions, whether that's because of poverty or crime or what have you. But it falls disproportionately upon, you know, urban minority communities. They're the ones who most often likely have their children taken from them. And that, you know, the ways in which race and class really sort of still function as limits about the kind of rights that parents have to their own children, and that poor parents have to worry about these kinds of things much more often than middle class and upper class white parents do. We often hear these stories of you know, African American mothers who work in McDonald's and they don't have childcare, and so they leave their, you know, 8-year-old child in the playground across the street from McDonald's, and they have their child taken away from them. You don't find those same, you know, you find those kinds of stories in the news fairly regularly. You don't find a sort of comparable example for, you know, white children being taken away from their parents.
At least white middle class
children. Right, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
Is an important, as you say, yeah. An important class dimension is. Okay, of the three examples, I want to pivot to the present a little bit. Of the three main examples we've discussed, children under slavery, Native American children in boarding schools, and the orphan trains, it seems to me, at least, that, as I said, in the first case with slavery, you get state complicity and state support, but it's to a large extent private activity.
Okay. Yeah.
In the other two cases, the state is taking a much more interventionist role and kind of, if you will, a much more active role in separating parents from their children for particular ends. In the cases, and I want to choose my words carefully here so I'm not misconstrued, but in the case of the boarding schools, Indian boarding schools, and the orphan train, the state actors who are engaged in that behavior would probably, with sincerity, claim that what they were doing was to benefit those children. We have a large amount of historic data to contradict that. I'm not.
Yeah, no, to be sure. Yeah,
but they would have said, no, this is for their own good.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, good. Because it seems to me that what's going on presently, and we had a report last week that the government has lost 1,500 children. Whether it's lost them or not, it's certainly lost contact with the people who have taken them, taken those children in, children who've been seized at the border. What we've seen with the current policy of the Trump administration seems to me to be qualitatively different, because you have the state, we have the state using its substantial coercive power to separate children from their parents, but it's doing so not for the benefit of those children, but as a deterrent. It's meant to deter immigration, further immigration, it seems to me. And when John Kelly, the chief of staff, was asked a couple of weeks back what would happen, he said they'll go into foster care or something. President Trump said, well, these kids aren't as innocent as you think they are, at one point, implies that everyone who's trying to cross the border is in the Salvadoran gang, MS-13. But there's a kind of...
They recruit very young, though. Well, you know, four-year-olds, they're really dangerous gangmen.
There's a point here, though, in the sense that There's a long-standing tradition, and we referenced this a few minutes ago with regard to police killings of young African Americans. There's a degree to which he's playing on a kind of powerful cultural belief that kind of non-white children are dangerous. Not the four-year-olds necessarily, but
4-year-olds grow up to be dangerous,
though. Of course. Yeah. Well, that's the point, isn't it? That is the point. And I think what we're seeing in the current moment is something qualitatively different from what's come before, because it seems to me to be deliberately punitive, without even the kind of reformist agenda as part of it. There's not even the fig leaf of reform. Would you agree with that?
I think that's right. I mean, I think trying to figure out, you know, what's their motivation for both creating this policy and enforcing existing policies to the extent, to this really extreme extent that they are, which seems to be in violation of international law and the rights of refugee seekers and all these kinds of things.
Yes, and President Trump has said it's because of legislation. It's not true. It's a policy. It's not the law.
President lies, but else is new. Anyway, I mean, there's a couple of things I think there's going on. One, I think that, as you point out, there's a intent that to dissuade people from immigrating to the United States on the supposition that people will be afraid of being separated from their children, so this will be a deterrent. The other motivation that I think might be going on, at least in part of this, is the relationship between this and the prison state. Because instead of allowing them into the United States and processing them to the courts, the idea of, well, we'll separate people and put them into prisons, and we'll send the parents to one prison, we'll send the children to another detention center, sometimes across the country from where their parents are. You know, these are oftenly privately run prisons where somebody's making a profit off of it. And, you know, one of the great horrors of the past 30, 40 years, the extent, the growth of the private prison state. You know, some people may have seen this going around on social media recently. There was an image of a bus for a federal prison that was just child seats.
Yes, I saw that.
You know, and you think about, okay, somebody is buying this and profiting from this, and so there's a financial incentive for at least some people to make a huge amount of money off of separating parents and children. Which is a heroic. You know, I think the primary motivation is obviously the deterrent one, and the ways in which, you know, minority children are conceived of as being inherently dangerous, just like immigrants are conceived of as being inherently dangerous.
But the sad lesson of this week's pod is that rather than being un-American, this is actually as American as apple pie.
I think that's right. Right? I think there's a very long. This fits into a very long history, a very long and traumatic history of parents being separated from their children, and the ways in which, you know, the integrity of families, especially minority families and poor families, is always, you know, contested and jeopardized.
But this is ongoing, and at risk of becoming activists. I mean, I think we would want our listeners, if you're not in the United States, contact the U.S. Embassy wherever you are and complain about this. If you are in the United States, contact your congressmen and women and your senators, because we have to make a fuss about this.
No, this is morally wrong. It's you know, as conducive to international law, it's legally wrong. I believe Nancy Pelosi actually is introducing a bill this morning to try to remedy it, although just the structure of the U.S. Congress right now means it's not going anywhere.
These are children.
Yes.
It's
yeah. So they're often children who are fleeing from really awful conditions in war-torn countries, and they're coming with their parents seeking protection. And the first thing that happens to them when they cross the American border, you know, seeking asylum, is being separated from their parents. That's a trauma built upon trauma. And that's really, you know, there's not a way one can justify that. All right. On that depressing note, we often end up on depressing notes. History is not a pleasant place.
No, well,
maybe the future will be better. Time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
Well, I hesitate to bring up President Trump again, but he's in Canada, or he wasn't. Yeah, he's in Canada today, and we'll be leaving tomorrow early. He's not staying for the whole summit.
He's missing the part with the environmental stuff.
Yes, but he's had a little bit of a stramash, as the Scots would say, this week with his counterpart, Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister. There's an
honorary graduate of the University of Edinburgh.
Indeed. There is a trade war brewing between the United States and Canada over steel tariffs and aluminum or aluminium, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. but as a backdrop to all of that, there was a bit of a back and forth over this over the past week. But apparently President Trump and Prime Minister Trudeau had a fairly touchy phone call, what our British friends would call a full and frank exchange of views.
Is that what that means? Okay.
Yes, that's exactly what that means. During which President Trump, it is reported, and it's been reported from multiple sources, so I think it's true, accused Canada of having burned the White House during the War of 1812, or burned Washington. And by implication, this is the tariffs are appropriate payback for that. This is problematic on a number of levels. One is that Canada as a nation state didn't exist for another five decades. So whether Canada could have actually burned the White House in 1814 is debatable or not. And of course, the United States was at war with Britain during the War of 1812. Yeah. So it was British forces that burned
Washington. Yeah, there are lots of Canadians who fight in the War of 1812, but they're not the ones who burned the White House.
Well, some of them did.
Oh, okay.
No. This is what's interesting about this to me, and I've lectured on the War of 1812 in Canada, and I have the scars to prove it. Canadians take the War of 1812 very, very seriously. Yes. And there are some Canadians who do make this, who make contend that Canada burned the War Washington during the War of 1812. It's not true, but there were some troops among the British forces that captured Washington in 1814 were some Canadian forces, or troops raised in Canada and that had previously served in Canada. Canada did not burn Washington, D.C. In 1814, whether you're an extreme American nationalist like President Trump or like some of our Canadian friends, not many, it must be said, but they, one does hear this occasionally. And what was interesting to me, kind of historiographically, was this was a dog whistle to certain quite nationalistic Canadians, which I'm sure was totally lost on President Trump.
Yes.
It's nonsense. And I'm not even going to go to the State Department spokeswoman who seemed to imply that the United States and Germany were on the same side during the D-Day invasion. We'll have to save that for another time. Anyway, read up on the War of 1812. It's important. It's the, it's a cornerstone in Canadian-American relations. But please don't listen to President Trump.
He seems to be obsessed with the War of 1812. Between that and the national anthem, you know.
That's true.
You know, he seems to, doesn't know anything about it, but he seems to be going back to the, the War of 1812 relevant in ways that hasn't been in a long time.
Let's make the War of 1812 great again. Let's not forget that his favorite president, Andrew Jackson, of course, achieved his great fame during the War of 1812.
Okay.
So there we go. And as you say, the national anthem comes from the War of 1812. So it's more relevant every day. Anyway, David, what's your last drop?
Okay, so I was in Pittsburgh last weekend. I made a very quick trip for the Society of Civil War Historians, which is my, one of my favorite conferences, and I had a great time in Pittsburgh. My preconception of what Pittsburgh looked like, I think, was drawn from the 19th century, and I was expecting it to be this industrial, awful place. Turns out Pittsburgh's awesome, and I have lots of things to recommend in Pittsburgh, but I only want to mention two, one of which is germane to the podcast. In the hotel we were staying in, there was a branch of the, I guess it's called the Wiggle Distillery. Are you familiar with this?
I am not.
Okay, this is a distillery that's actually named after one of the people executed during the Whiskey Rebellion.
Oh, right.
So, you know, it felt very appropriate.
One of our founders.
Exactly. And so I had a flight of their whiskey, and I can, you know, I'm usually not a big rye whiskey fan, but this was really, really good. So I can, you know, I was imagining that I was in the Whiskey Rebellion or with the Whiskey Rebels, drinking the last of their untaxed whiskey. So I want to recommend the Wiggle Distillery from Pittsburgh. The other thing I want to recommend is the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh, which is sort of their local history museum. Which has a lot of really great exhibits about local history. They got some things about the sports teams in Pittsburgh, and they got some things about sort of the settlement in Pittsburgh and the steel and all that kind of stuff. But they also have a really great exhibit on Mr. Rogers. And as my endorsement from last episode of Marvel, I really like Mr. Rogers. I have a heart, you know, soft spot in my heart.
Is he from Pittsburgh?
I guess it started on a Pittsburgh station. It was a local television show before broadcast nationally. And so they had the set there from Mr. Rogers, and it was just really emotionally moving to see the shoes and the whole thing and the treehouse and the castle.
David, we're probably skewing a little bit old on this. You might want to just very briefly explain to our listeners who Mr. Rogers is, because our British listeners will never have seen. And a lot of our American listeners will be too.
Well, I believe there's a documentary of Mr. Rogers that's coming out this week. So if you don't know about Mr. Rogers, Frank is doesn't seem to have the share of my enthusiasm for Mr. Rogers. So he was a figure on American public television for the better part of, must have been 30 or 40 years. It had this show that was largely about telling children it's okay to be a child and be friends with people and making mistakes is okay. And, you know, it's a
Mr. Rogers'
neighborhood, right? And so he goes and he visits his neighbors and he has, you know, it goes on little field trips and there's some little thing with puppets that's really great. They had lots of the puppets at the Heinz History Center and they don't look as magical in real life as they do on television, but, you know, television magic. But it's a really sort of important part of American cultural history, I think, from the late 20th century in terms of, you know, here's something that's being funded by public television, but was really, you know, designed to, you know, help little children adjust to all the difficulties of being a little child.
It's kind of like Blue Peter for our British.
Okay.
Listeners.
I'll take your word for it.
Right.
Okay. All right, on that note, cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.